Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 14th of February, 2013, and I'm coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan. Today we're joined on the line from France, actually, by the Geneva Business Insider himself, David L. Smith. Once again, his website is the Geneva Business Insider at genevabusinessinsider.blogspot.com, which is a bit of a mouthful, but of course the link will be in the show notes for this interview. So David, thank you once again for your time this month.
Pleasure to be here once again.
Well, let's start this month's conversation with an interesting pronouncement from the G7 this week, basically a joint statement that they issued just earlier this week to the effect of there is no currency war. We are not doing anything to interfere with the normal exchange of currencies on the market, and nor do we plan to do anything of the sort. Basically, that's the gist of their message ahead of the G20 meeting later this week in Moscow. Personally, I don't think it's worth the paper it's written on, and I think it's just flatly contradicted by everything we see going on from Japan to Washington to the Europe and even in South America now. But what's your take on this statement and what it really means?
Well, I pretty much agree with you. I mean, all of these events are just designed to say the opposite of what they really mean. It's like Davos, they come out of Davos saying the recovery is there when they have probably spent all their time discussing the fact it isn't and what the hell to do about it. So when you look at the G7 now talking about there being no currency wars, how can you explain away the fact that the Japanese currency has dropped by 15% in the last few months? Now, we have the same thing with in the UK with Mervyn King doing a kind of rear guard action to maintain some kind of order, and the Carney coming in with nothing really but promises that one way or another he's going to debase the currency further. And of course, you then see Weidmann talking about the euro and trying to talk the euro down. So they are all doing one thing, denying it, and trying to provoke the reaction of debasement of their currency, either in words or in acts. Now, if you take the acts, what Mr. Abe is about to embark upon is probably the last train to disaster that Japan is ever going to see. Because if you have a collapsing currency, there reaches a point where a country like Japan, which is heavily dependent on imports for all of its manufacturing, it's going to start paying huge prices for rubber, huge prices for oil. And I seem to remember that they had the same kind of thing that happened in the late 30s, and we all know where that ended up with was an attack on Pearl Harbor some 10 years later. So I'm looking forward to seeing Japan walking out of the G7 meeting as they did out of the League of Nations.
Well, we will have to see how that plays out, but I just personally think that it's basically set in stone at this point, and what the G7 says is really just to try to assure markets one way or another, but I don't think it's actually reflective of reality. One interesting part in all of this, I mean, we're talking about the quantitative easing, which is devaluing a lot of the currencies, for example, in Japan, in Washington, in Europe. But there's another type of devaluation going on. For example, we saw in Venezuela just last week, the Bolivar was devalued by, I believe, one third, just on the whim and the fiat decree of President for life, seemingly, Chavez, who may be shuffling off this mortal coil in the near future, but I don't expect the socialist experiment he's started there to wither away upon his death. What's your take on what's happening there in Venezuela and also in Argentina, which we've also seen institute some price controls recently to try to curb the runaway inflation, which the statisticians in Argentina have been desperately trying to hide for the last 7 years since they scrapped the old statisticians and instituted some government-mandated ones, and now we have price controls being put in Argentina. What's happening there in South America, and how does this play into the bigger picture right now?
Well, South America is not an area I know quite as well as Europe, but if you take what's happening in Venezuela, we have a very sick president who is basically a very left-wing and portrayed as a crazy character. I think actually he's less crazy than he appears in as much as the craziness is painted by by the West and in particular America because it suits their book. But his experiment is leading to, you know, suffering for the people in the country. You also have the issue, of course, of the fact he upset the powers that be by asking to repatriate his gold. which actually shows him to have been a lot smarter than Angela Merkel was, because at least he actually physically got it. So, you know, that's my initial take on Venezuela. If you look at Argentina, I've followed that a little bit because I was involved about 10 years ago when they had their last currency collapse and their last major devaluation. And at that time, I mean, the situation was desperate, at least for the rich who were loading up their security wagons and shipping the money out to the U.S. to be laundered in the U.S. banks. And, of course, for the poor, for which life got absolutely horrible. So then, of course, the next thing that happened is there was a big devaluation, and they claimed that all the problems had been solved. And once again, rather like the West, having pretended the problems were solved, the reality was different. So the most important thing to be done then is to suppress reality. Now, being British, I've remembered from a long time ago the battles over the Falkland Islands, and the reasons that were given at that time for, you know, there was a great deal of disturbance in the country, and of course creating a real enemy like the British on an island which had been sovereign for them for hundreds of years seemed like a good idea. So if you witness what Madame Kirchner is doing now, it is just a replay of history of 30 years ago. The economy is getting worse. They're looking at a further collapse. You know, you have to devalue massively the currency, otherwise you're not going to get out of the hole. So she nationalizes businesses. She's dipped into the middle class's pension plans to take money to bolster the state. In fact, basically, she's just doing everything to ensure the state's survival at the expense of the people. And for me, this is very, very likely to be the trends in America. I mean, if you think President Obama should be looking jealously over her shoulder saying, gee, I wish I could get my hands on the $16 trillion of U.S. pension money to fill some of the gaps that I have here. So it is really, for me, it's a very unhappy story, but it is very indicative of what the more sophisticated West supposedly is going to have to face very shortly, and the techniques used against the people and against international companies who try to do business there will be exactly the same.
Well, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about your memories of that Argentinian currency collapse from 10 years ago. What did that look like? How did that play out? And what lessons can be learned from that type of experience?
Well, it is difficult to see the differences between what was going on then and what's going on now. I mean, it was a government that was overspending. They had their currency pegged to the dollar. Their imports, you know, there was no way of sustaining the exchange rate that they had fixed. And eventually, those who were smart, it just led to capital flight out of the country. And on the basis of you get your money back, get your money out now, wait for the collapse, wait for the change in the exchange rate, and bring your money back in, it's worth twice as much. Now, that works for the privileged few, but for the people inside the country, then it's a little bit like you know, it's a little bit like what Japan is setting up at the moment. And if you look at the price of gold in Japan in yen, it's never been higher. So we are seeing exactly the same thing from the first world to the third world of if you're smart and you can see what's coming, you can protect yourself. And if you're not, you're just going to end up with less and less.
Very true. But of course, all this seems to paint a picture of the region being one on the verge of collapse or one that's heading towards that scenario. And yet you have, for example, the World Bank projecting 3.9% growth in GDP for Latin America in 2013. You have the UN Economic Commission projecting 3.8% growth. This is over 150% of the 2.4% growth that's projected for global growth, and yet only 1.3% growth is being projected for high-income countries, the developed world, so to speak. Is this indicative of an overall trend that shows that the developed countries are going to be the places with maximal investment returns in the coming years, or is there something else at play here?
Well, I mean, I spend part of my time being an investment advisor, and if you look at the situation at the moment, most countries have very unattractive investment profiles in the developed world. the companies within those countries that have good prospects are those which are completely multinational, or those who are basically serving these developing countries. And, you know, when you talk about a 1.4% GDP growth, you know, the figures are so manipulated that you've no idea whether that includes inflation or not, or how much or how little. So, I mean, a 1% growth to me is a meaningless figure. If you're talking about 3 to 5% growth, then it's very different. There's something real there. But you just have to look. I mean, we come back to looking at the demographics. I was looking recently at some of the developing countries, not only in Latin America, but in Africa. And you see tremendous differences in profiles of the population. You have countries where the average population age is 20 years old. Now, these are often those that have survived the civil war, or those that have major health problems. But you compare that to the West, where everyone is queuing up to retire. And I guess the ultimate poster child for that is undoubtedly Japan, where they're going to have to cannibalize what they have in the way of government bonds to feed the old age pensioners. And then, of course, the finance ministry comes on and says, when your bonds come to mature, don't worry, we'll look after you. I mean, it is a complete joke. And to think that this was in the 1950s and 60s, the country that was the greatest economic threat, which had the greatest economic boom that's ever seen, and 30 years later, basically having followed rigorously the policies which Mr. Bernanke is loving to follow right now, and Carney is going to follow, and everybody else, they're doomed to failure with a population which demographically it makes it impossible for them to get out of the trap they built for themselves. And of course, then the only thing left is devalue the currency and push the problem forward until collapse.
The image certainly is one of a bunch of lemmings following each other off the cliff. And I guess at the very least here in Japan, I have a front row seat to see what the cliff looks like. But that's not necessarily the seat I want to be sitting in. Yeah. Well, let's move back to Europe, and in fact, your home territory of Switzerland, where there's been some interesting moves in the gold markets recently, and I'm picking this up from a couple of sites. First of all, we have one from bullionvault.com, which is saying that a campaign to see Switzerland repatriate all its gold bullion held abroad is close to hitting its target of collecting 100,000 signatures as part of an attempt to trigger a referendum on the issue. And of course, as people know, Switzerland is a referendum-run kind of country, with the people having a much bigger say over their government than in most other countries. So that's a very interesting issue. And on the backs of those reports, we're getting some more reports about some of the interesting moves to create allocated gold accounts in some of the big Swiss banks. So, for example, ibtimes.com covering this. What's behind moving Swiss bank clients from unallocated to allocated gold accounts? And this reads, quote, Swiss banks UBS and Credit Suisse have moved to offer allocated gold and silver accounts to their clients, including high net worth individuals, hedge funds, other banks, and institutions. The move allows these entities to take direct ownership of their bullion in allocated accounts. In addition, their storage fees have been raised by 20%. The reason being is that the banks say that they are making the move to reduce exposure and risks on balance sheet and in an effort to be more transparent. Is there more to this than meets the eye? We believe there is much more, and it is a warning for us. And the report goes on from there. A lot of reports coming out about this issue right now from Switzerland. What can you tell us there on the ground about what is happening right now? Why are people so concerned about the physical holding of their gold right now in Switzerland?
Well, once again, this is just little more than a smokescreen, because these banks have always been offering allocated gold. It's as simple as that. So you can go into a Swiss bank and have allocated gold if you wish. This is nothing more than a marketing tool to try and put them in give people the impression that they're solid and reliable and all the rest. But at the end of the day, if you look at the UBS and Credit Suisse, both of these banks have been embroiled in all kinds of maneuvers to ensure their survival at the expense of the taxpayer. Over the past years, and UBS, if you've watched recently, the grinding losses they make on every side, and the loss of credibility. This is a way to try and reinforce their credibility again. So I don't buy it at all. I just take it as a further effort, you know, failing effort to try and prove that they're reliable. And quite frankly, if I were having allocated gold, I certainly wouldn't put it in any vaults controlled by UBS or Credit Suisse or any of the other too big to fail banks. These people, one phone call from the central bank, they close the banks down and you can't get into your vault, and it may be perfectly allocated, but there's no point in having something allocated if you can't get your hands on it. So whatever you do, if you go into gold allocated or otherwise, make sure that it's not under the control of one of the major banks, either as custodian or directly.
How about on the issue of the broader national concern with the referendum potentially being forced to try to repatriate the national gold holdings? What's behind this, and does this tie into some of the other moves we've seen from the Bundesbank and other European countries to show some concern about physical gold?
Yeah, this is a fascinating development, and in fact, last week I went to a lunch or event organized to discuss it by a group of independent financial asset managers. And they had a panel discussion on it. The situation actually was that officially they had 100,000 votes, but when the actual scrutiny of all the signatures was done, they discovered that they didn't. So there are some flaws in the Swiss democratic system as well. So now they're looking to get up to the 100,000 votes. And if there are any Swiss people listening to this, I can only strongly encourage them to sign the referendum, sign the request for the referendum. Now, what did come out of it was one of the questions I asked at the meeting, which actually was greeted with applause, was to talk about the fact that Mr. Lars Schall, a journalist in Germany, has been struggling between the Federal Reserve and the Swiss National Bank to get transparency on these matters for years without any success. There was also a quote of Mr. Villiger, who was one of the national councillors, who was asked when he was finance minister, what about the Swiss gold? And he says, I don't know, I don't want to ask, and I'm not going to ask. He did not, however, hand in his resignation on the spot, and he just stayed in place. Now, the last thing that's interesting about the Swiss National Bank is its ownership, because the owners are the individual states that compose the Federation of Switzerland and the individual state-owned banks, which are providing, you know, financing to local people and a small pool of private investors. And I said, well, if we cannot get this thing done politically, well, then let's do it in using the company laws, so we can convoke an extraordinary general meeting of the Swiss National Bank, and we order them to produce the information. At which point, one of the national councillors who was present said, "Oh, but this is political, because basically, you have to think who is sitting in on the board of these state banks and in the cantons." And of course, he basically admitted that the Swiss were losing control of their democratic system. And I said, look, you know, you're one of the few countries that is left that still has a democratic system. And if you want to lose it completely, as has happened in America, then all you have to do is sit and do nothing for the next 20 years. So there was an atmosphere of, for some, I think, shock, because there's the Swiss, although they're very democratic, they also have a very high developed sense of the system is there and the system works for them. And when you demonstrate to them the system is not working for them, in fact, it's systematically working against them and for international banking interests instead, it does not compute. So I think there are a few people who went home having to think about the situation, and it does pose a much broader question of how the Swiss Parliament is manipulated just the same way as all the other ones are.
And the further question of the international gold holdings for various central banks and how much gold is really held by these various banks and who controls them. And on that note, I mean, one of the things that has really fallen off the radar for a lot of mainstream news reporting, but that is still quite, I think, a big concern, is what happened to the Libyan gold? Do we have any idea what happened to all of that gold that was being held by Libya?
One could ask a lot of questions and draw a few conclusions, but you could say that the West never attacked Libya for its gold, for its oil, sorry. But you could all, maybe they did it for the gold, I don't know. But Libya basically had approximately $6 billion worth of gold. This gold, when once the Gaddafi fell, disappeared. And there has been a story that some of it physically reappeared in Cairo. And of course, there is absolutely no following whatsoever by any of the major mainstream media as to what happened to the biggest theft, or physical theft, that ever has taken place. Now, if you talk about financial theft and paper theft, thefts have been much larger than that, and they're still ongoing. But have you ever heard of a bank robbery for $6 billion, which just goes uncommented on for months, if not years? No. So,
well, when the robbers are the U.S. military and NATO allies.
Well, this is exactly what one could logically suspect. Because if you were trying to invade a country and you knew its central bank had a vault, it's a lot more interesting to put your special forces around that bank than to put it around some, you know, missile launching facility in the middle of the desert. So, and it's also interesting that very shortly after Libyan gold disappeared, the tension in the gold markets, in the futures markets, suddenly started to subside, and because there was ready capability to provide physical to meet the demand. So if I were being a suspicious detective, I would be saying, well, you know, I think France and the UK have got fairly sticky fingers. But I guess we'll not know for the next 50 years, if ever.
Probably, unfortunately, so. But at the very least, as you say, it certainly lines up into a logical story. And on that note, of course, we're seeing France's incursion into Mali right now, and Mali with some untapped gold deposits. Is there any possible relation there?
Well, I think that the Mali story and the Niger story are very interesting demonstrations of France's desire to maintain its colonialist hold. I mean, the way things very approximately work is that France has been left as the Africa has been left as the fief of the French, and the Middle East the fief of the British in terms of military presence. And of course, the US now is trying to muscle in with any excuse it can get. So if you look at Mali, the interesting thing is to look just across the border to Niger. And in Niger, you have the biggest source of uranium, which just happens to supply the French company Areva, which is the biggest nuclear energy country in the world. So they have to make sure that they can ensure their sources. Now, if you take it a step further, then you look at the energy which comes into the UK, which is owned and controlled by EDF, which is a French electricity company. That also is generated in large part from nuclear. So what you're seeing is Mali is about to be renamed. It's going to be called Malareva very shortly because of takeover essentially by the French interest to protect their supply of uranium. And then, of course, Mali is a big precious metals and basic raw materials producer. So there's lots of interest in coming in. And of course, the Americans are there with their drones and trying to build up AFRICOM into something more spectacular. And I see that General Ham is using his usual ham-fisted approach to expand his empire.
Nice pun. All right, well, in our preparation for this interview, you also indicated you wanted to talk about the ratings agencies and their role in the current system and how that might be changing, given some of the changes that are coming in. Tell us a little bit about the ratings agencies and how they play into the economic times that we're living in right now.
Yeah, well, the rating agencies are there to be theoretically independent and to provide investors with the comfort that what they're investing in is actually what it's said to be. So they're meant to go in, they should analyze, they come up with reports as to whether any particular security is AAA, BBB, or CCC. And this is normally a very, very necessary thing to have. But we've reached the stage with the rating agencies now where the EU was trying to trying to say we should ban rating agencies from rating anything. And in the US, the approach is rather different. It's a kind of mafia approach that as long as you say what we want you to say, then you can carry on saying it. And if you don't, then we're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. So the first case, you know, a few months ago, there were hearings by the rating agencies where they're all taken in front of Congress. And they all said, oh, we're very sorry. We got carried away helping the sell side people you know, push their bonds and stocks or whatever else it was, and we've been bad boys and so on. And then, of course, that dies down. And then you have an agency like Fitch, who were basically financed by individuals who wanted to have objective rating agencies, who provided objective ratings and were immediately attacked by the SEC mercilessly from every side. And I believe they were banned from operating for a period of 12 months. So you got rid of one of the people, one of the truthsayers in the Ministry of Truth. And then you move on to the S&P and the Moody's, where one is attacked, whereas, you know, both were doing exactly the same, and one is attacked and one is not. Now, the one that's not attacked just happens to have a major shareholder called Warren Buffett. So one could always pose the question, could there be some kind of link between the reactions of Mr. Holder and the shareholding of the company and the political allegiances of one of the major shareholders?
I think we know the answer to that, but yes, yeah. Exactly. And just to put it on the table, Reuters came out last week to say that the DOJ is still contemplating a lawsuit against Moody's for defrauding investors. So we'll see how vigorously that lawsuit is prosecuted, if and when it should ever actually come.
The other most beautiful thing of all is two of the major banks, I think it was Citi and Bank of America, were threatening to sue the rating agencies. I have actually started a case against the rating agencies, saying that the rating agencies caused them loss by misrating the products that Citi and Bank of America had made, built, and pumped and sold. So we're in a point of surrealistic farce in anything to do with the financial world to such an extent that I'm happy to be up here in the mountains in Switzerland, you know, where most of these things seem a long, long, long way away.
I can certainly understand that feeling, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, it's such a economic world of farce that really it's being driven by what we are being told by the various politicians, and I think the G7 pronouncement that there is no currency war, despite the fact that we see one happening, is just another example of almost the type of economic hubris that's taking over the markets right now, where simply governments and central banksters decreeing something is enough to supposedly make it so and drive markets appropriately. The question, of course, is when will the general public wake up to the actual smoke and mirrors that's really propping all of this up? And I think it cannot be sustained inevitably, and it's going to collapse sooner or later. At any rate, that's, I think, going to do it for our conversation this month. Tell people again about the website and what they can find there.
Very good. Well, my website is the GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. It has a link to my business website, which is called Famisa. I provide basically financial and advisory services to high net worth individuals and corporations. And if anything that you've heard is of interest, don't hesitate to contact me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I'm looking forward to talking to you again next month. Enjoy the rest of your month.
Thank you very much. Okay. Bye-bye.